there, everybody. It is October 10th, 2013, and you are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send that email on over to ken@thisshowissogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowissogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. Right there on the homepage, you can submit a question to our relationship expert, Dr. Frankie. She's actually going to be on later this episode answering all of your questions, and there are some amazing questions. We're going to be talking about fetishes and open relationships and all these fun things. So later in the show, you will hear Dr. Frankie, but you can submit questions to her there on thisshowissogay.com. Follow us on Twitter. Every now and then we use it, so you should follow us. And of course, go to the Facebook, like us, because we sure as heck like you. What an episode we have for you this week. We must get started with our first guest. Brian Nash is a singer, a piano player, a music arranger, a music director, a producer, a host, and take it from me, he's a bit of a screwball. A trained classical voice and operatic singer, he has played all over the world, from piano bars in New York City to the gayest of cruise ships to even backing up the daughter of a bona fide Bravo Real Housewife. And now he's here with us. Brian Nash, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Well, hey there.
I am so excited to speak with you because we have a ton of ground to cover. Are you ready?
I'm into it. I'm ready.
So we got to go back. We start with you. You're one of our musical guests, so we start with you as we start with all of our musical guests. Why the medium of music to get your voice across?
I think I always, it's something that I always did, even when I was a tiny, tiny wee toddlet. I mean, I had an Annie wig that we got at Toys R Us that I would be living that dream. And then I left it out in the rain, and the color of leaves shot up past it, and it got scraggly, and then it became my Cyndi Lauper wig. That's what her hair was doing at the time. So it was, I just always did it. It was never like a conscious choice. So it was just always my thing. I wrote and did other things. I mean, I didn't start playing until later, but I always sang.
Well, let's do a little Brian Nash, This Is Your Life. We go back, and I know there's time before this, but I'm reading you were in the Barrington Children's Choir.
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
I remember that I got into it because Michelle McGowan was really mean to me on the playground, and she said that if I could actually sing, I'd be in the Barrington Children's Choir like she was. And I was not gonna let that little blonde demon get the better of me, so I auditioned the next opportunity and got in.
Are you Facebook friends with Michelle McGowan?
No.
No.
I should hunt her down.
Okay.
And, you know, just rub it in, but, you know, I'm sure she's somewhere being a lovely mother and housewife and evil beast to her children. So, mazel tov, wherever you are, Michelle McGowan. Our conductor, Peggy Crawford, was and is a genius, and she really, really inspired me and kind of got my musicianship in check. And then she took all the boys who were in the choir to see the American Boy Choir when they were on tour.
And the American Boy Choir, you toured all around. Apparently, if I listen to an Amy Grant Christmas album, which I assume she has many, I assume she has many of them, but on one of them, I can hear you.
It's the Home for Christmas album, I believe. So I think it's the second. I think she puts out a Christmas album every 10 minutes. I mean,
it really is.
She's a little Christian, so good for her. She's got things to do. But we toured all over the place, and it was amazing. I mean, we went to Taiwan and Czechoslovakia and Poland and just sang at Carnegie and Lincoln Center. And that was unbelievable. That was such a brilliant experience and so formative.
That's awesome.
So much so that I actually got married at the school.
Look at that. I thought you were going to say I got married to Amy Grant. I'm like, I don't think I saw that in the news.
I got married to Amy Grant. And then she dumped me for Tim McGraw. Is she married to Tim McGraw?
I think they are indeed still married, yes.
Okay. I can't remember if it was Faith Hill or, somebody.
Oh, no, you're right. I think that is Faith Hill. Amy Grant.
Married to somebody.
Yeah. All right, we'll look that up. We'll have our crack research team look at that. And then, as naturally you would, you went to Catholic high school for a couple years.
Yeah, just for a bit. You kind of got it. It's what you do when you grow up in Chicago. It's just, you have to go to a couple years of Catholic high school. I terrorized them and came out while I was there.
Oh.
And that was scandalous. And so I ended up having to do like a Q&A on gay people with my religion class. I literally, like, my teacher gave me a class to discuss the issue of homosexuality.
Wow.
And I fielded questions and, you know, gave them, you know, biblical passages that contradict Leviticus. It was insane.
Huh.
A lot of things. We
all
also
right.
did an all-white production of The Wiz, which was not good, but that's fine.
Oh, that must have been something to behold. What part did you play? I'm almost nervous to ask.
I was the title character. I was the aforementioned Wiz.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot. I was doing a lot of Andre de Shields, like 1970s Ben Vereen magical, you know, black man hands. It was so many things.
Now, I don't know if you know this. I don't know how familiar you are with the Wiz, but none of those people are white.
No, not and one. That's the whole point. It is the African American musicalization of The Wizard of Oz, and we had two black people in it. Charmaine was Dorothy, clearly, and then my dear friend Abby played Aunt Em.
Why do they choose these? This is like those high schools, the high schools that choose to do, like the all-white high schools that choose to do Once on This Island. I write to them and say, why? Why would you do that?
Well, now they've rewritten the script so you can do an all-white Once on This Island, because mainly that's who's doing it. So they've changed, it's about poor versus rich, as opposed to the race relations. Yeah, it's insane.
It's like doing an all-white Seussical. You just can't do it.
I saw an all-white Showboat in a high school in Wisconsin once. That made no sense.
Rock. That's so...
That was like, people all work on this. It made no sense. It was terrible.
All right, well, we'll skip ahead a bit. We'll skip ahead a bit. We'll skip Interlochen, although we have to kind of cover that, because that's where a very special redhead came into your life, I'm reading online. There.
Oh, indeed.
A lovely lady who used to... I do my research. It's not my first show. It's show number 233, my friend. A lovely lady who used to make sense, and we'll talk about whether or not she still does, a lovely lady named Tori Amos.
Yes, absolutely. Actually, Casey Stratton, who was at Interlochen and was a couple years ahead of me, who's a brilliant singer-songwriter, played one of her songs at, you know, they had like a coffee shop where the artsy kids could let down their classical hair and play whatever the hell they wanted. So Casey got up and played Silent all these years. And this is in 94.
Oh, yeah.
94.
Yeah.
So, it was 94 because Under the Pink hadn't come out yet. So this is early Tori, and I fell in love. The entire campus got obsessed. There were buses, or they took vans to the mall on the day that Under the Pink came out so all the kids could get it. It was a lot. But that made me want to play the piano. I'd had one lesson when I was six, and then I stopped right away. But it made me want to play again, so I went down into the basement practice rooms at Interlochen and started teaching myself how to play the piano, and her stuff was the first stuff I ever learned.
Now, Tori is not only an just incredible, incredible piano player, but for folks who don't know, and I don't know how they wouldn't, but for folks who don't know, she also has a distinctive piano style there on the bench.
Yeah, I mean, as she's gotten older, that's calmed down a little bit. You know, it's probably bad for the hips. But, you know, she is generally a straddle the piano bench.
Did you mimic that as well?
Yeah, kind of. It's kind of just happened. Like, sure, playing is very, very physical, and that was my primary influence. So as I learned how to play, that's kind of how I did it. So
nice.
If you watch me play, I guess there are still some physical Tori-isms in there. But, you know, it just makes sense to open up the leg to the audience. You know, so you can look at the audience.
This is a family show, Brian Nash. It's a family show. Leave it there.
It's not about exposing one's respective junk to an audience. No, it's really just about opening up so the audience can see you, can see your face, can connect better to an audience.
Worst Tori cover you've ever seen someone do. Go.
Oh my God, there are a lot. And, you know, probably some of mine are, you know, if you ask this question to anyone, some of the Tory people, you know, kind of hate that I cover her. But that's fine. But, there was a cover of Butterfly, which is from, I can't remember. It was one of the soundtracks, about kids in some school that were, you know, rebellious. There was a song called Butterfly that she did, and there was a cover that somebody played for me that was just indecipherable and hilarious. Oh, Wing also covered some Tori.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Wing, the 65-year-old woman who moved from Hong Kong to New Zealand and then was on South Park. She speaks no English, but somebody asked her to cover Mr. Zebra, and it is magical.
Can I tell you my worst one? Mine is pretty good. When I was at NYU, and we should do some disclosure here, Brian and I have actually met. We know each other, so we go back many, many years. But when I was at NYU, they asked me to chaperone the Daytona Beach Cheerleading Championships, which was a whole thing in itself. So I was there on Daytona Beach, and the small little blonde girls were rehearsing their routines. And one of the groups, and I don't know what school that they were from, but one of the troops of all blonde little gymnast girls throwing into the air were doing a routine to a remix of Me and a Gun.
I knew it was going to be Me and a Gun. I knew it.
For
because
folks who don't know,
sexual assault.
Yes, for folks who don't know, that's disturbing on so many levels. It's not empowering, not empowering. By the way, this just in from our crack research team, Amy Grant married to Vince Gill.
Vince Gill, oh, thank God.
Now, all those folks who stopped listening because they had to go look it up, they can tune back in. All right, well, we're jumping ahead. So then you go to Boston. You go to Boston, and I'm reading that that was really some of your first exposure to piano bars.
Yeah, totally. I was at Boston Conservatory. I was studying opera performance, but me being me, that wasn't, you know, everything that I wanted to do. So I was doing a lot of theater and, you know, teaching and doing stuff. But I snuck underage into a piano bar across the street from the Wang Center in Boston called Encore. And that's, you know, eventually I started playing there. I started playing for this disaster by the name of Lucky Dupre. She was a former call girl who had somehow gotten a Saturday night shift at the piano bar. No voice. And like, she was one of those singers who pulls away from the mic for the notes that are so powerful, but she just, because she doesn't have them. So she'd be like, I'm through it, and nothing would come out, but she'd pull the mic away just to make it look like she was giving you something.
Let me pause right there. Is it possible that Lucky Dupre was the stage name of that girl from the playground?
Could be. No, well, no. Unless she dyed the hair black and got enormous implants.
All right. I'm not ruling it out.
Yeah, I mean, it could be. There was a lot of surgery that had gone on with Miss Lucky. Yeah. She was nicknamed Lucky because that's what she smoked. She smoked Lucky Strike.
Oh, look at that. It's almost literal.
Yeah. Oof. And she was not. Last I heard, she was living downstairs with my friend Stacy and had a raging case of scabies. But that's a whole other story. Yeah, so I started playing for Lucky, and then they gave me my own night with my friend Justin, and we rocked out the Wednesday night and Saturday nights for a couple of years there.
Amazing. Amazing. Now, yeah. I am so excited to talk about piano bars, and folks don't really know how excited I am, but you will hear it in a couple seconds, because this is one of those slices of gay culture that, if you have not experienced it, it is such a vibrant, integral piece. I really believe this, of gay culture. It was my formative years were spent in piano bars in New York City that most people don't really know about, either because they don't have a piano bar or because, and let's put this theory out there, they're dying. You know, there's so many, maybe they're not dying, but there's so many less than there used to be.
Yeah.
Tell people what a piano bar is. How would you even describe it? Because to flash forward, you end up going to New York City and you end up working at the Duplex, which is one of the best places I've ever been fired from. And it's an incredible place right there on the corner of, what are we at, Christopher and 7th?
Christopher and 7th Avenue, yeah.
Right next door to the Stonewall. So tell people, describe a piano bar to someone who's never been there before.
Well, a piano bar basically is, it's a bar that has a piano in it.
Look at that.
And magic. But the pianist is generally playing and singing and taking requests, and the staff, the bartender and the waitress also get up and sing. So, and, you know, members of the audience can get up and sing if they want to. So it's basically a bunch of generally long 7-hour stretch of just people playing and singing and tomfoolery and that it's fun and enjoyable and weird and, you know,
how gay is it?
It's gotten significantly less gay over the
years.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing, like, the piano bars of yore, you know, that in the 50s, 60s, that people kind of generally remember and know, was generally a gentleman pianist playing standards, generally not singing, kind of backgroundy, and people would gather around the piano and sing. And now it's amplified and it's mainly pop rock. It used to be mainly show tunes and standards, and now it's really rare that you get that. To get that kind of music.
I don't even want to do this show anymore.
I know. I know. I know. It hurts.
Okay. All right. Well, that's upsetting, and there's that. But one of the most amazing things about piano bars and why I love the duplex, and, you know, I used to work at a place called, and I can't remember if it was before you, it must have been before you got to New York City. I used to work at a place called The Oaks, which was owned by the same guy who still owned the duplex.
Yeah.
And one of the most amazing things about working in those environments was that someone really could wander in off the street, and I don't know if this still happens, so you have to tell me, sing a song at the piano and just blow you away and just and wander back out. And they just don't maybe have whatever the look is of Broadway. And I argue that there's more talent in the piano bars than there is on Broadway.
It's a very different skill. Like, there are people who, you know, have done, you know, 4, 5, 17 Broadway shows who come into the piano bar and don't kill it. Like, they, because that way of connecting to an audience on such an intimate level, you really have to watch your room and be invested in people who are 4 feet in front of you.
Right.
And tell that kind of story instead of just kind of blowing it out and playing it to the mezzanine. It's a very specific skill set. And there are some people who can do that and some people where it's really hard for them.
I'm still on the part where it's not as gay as it used to be.
Well, that's the thing, that's kind of the tragic thing about it. The clientele who would go in and really wanted to hear show tunes and wanted to have that kind of standards, Cole Porter experience, we lost so many of them.
Yeah.
The people who would go in to sing.
Yeah.
So the rooms kind of had to change.
Right.
And at the same time that was happening, karaoke started becoming a thing.
Right.
So people, you know, straight chicks from Jersey would come in and think it was a karaoke bar. So the music shifted at the same time that the clientele had to shift.
Yeah.
So now there are straight girls who come in and want Don't Stop Believing.
Give me the three songs that you would like to, but can't because, you know, your staff would like to ban from people coming up and singing.
I would ban. It's weird because there aren't that like, you know, no one, everyone sings on my own every day. Like, that doesn't really happen as much anymore. I think a lot of straight girls do want to get up there and sing Don't Stop Believing and live their karaoke dreams.
Okay.
Let's see. What else are people just singing to death? Someone Like You by Adele.
Oh, that, you're not supposed to do that.
I know. If you're not Adele.
Right.
You know, some people can cover it and get away and, like, be invested with it and be brilliant. But it's such a tragic and gorgeous song that if you're kind of wasted and kind of don't know the words, then
My boyfriend who doesn't know it, Adam Levine, always tells me on The Voice, you are not supposed to be singing Adele.
Yeah, no.
All right.
No. Well, Adam Levine really shouldn't be singing Adele. I'd like to see that. I would like to see Maroon 5 do an Adele covers album.
From your lips to really no one's ears, Brian. Nobody wants to hear that. So it's just, that's not going to happen.
Maroon 5, 21. That'll be good.
And then I will ask you one more. And for this one, there is a correct answer. So I'm telling you that in advance. The most moving rendition of Suddenly Seymour you have ever heard. Keep in mind, there is a correct answer.
Did you ever sing it with me?
Yes! Come on! The correct answer was Ken Schneck and Kate Bazakis, 2002.
2002?
Yeah.
Oh my god. Are you sure it wasn't 2003?
It might have been 2003.
Yeah, I think it was 2003. I didn't start playing the duplex. I barely moved to the city in 2002. Like, the last half of 2002.
Kate, a former guest on this show, yes, if I had a nickel for every Suddenly Seymour that she and I have done, I could get a gumball or two. Now, we mentioned in the opening, you have played on perhaps the gayest cruise of all the cruises. We enjoy it immensely, the Our Family Vacations cruise.
It is, yeah. I played on the first, you know, I played on most of them for years when they were doing full charter cruises. I played on the very first one.
I've never been on a cruise in my life.
Oh, we need to change that.
Really?
Now I'm playing on all the Atlantis cruises, and those are
pretty gay too. Yeah.
Those are real gay.
What's it like playing on a cruise? How does that differ from your piano bar life?
On Our Family, I was kind of doing the same thing. I was kind of doing like mini piano bar sets, which are great and fun. And also because they had, you know, every Broadway star in the history of mankind on the cruises. So Billy Porter would wander up and sing a song, and McArdle would sing Take Me or Leave Me with her daughter, which was weird, but kind of hilarious. And they were kind of calling out that it was slightly incestuous, but that was just what they both knew the words to, so they were going to do it. It's so fun. Daphne Rubin Vega, just like a little, you know, a little toasty at 2 a.m, trying to get through songs that she'd sung on Broadway but hadn't sung in 3 years, you know, trying to remember the words and having the audience help her out. It's great and so fun.
Community. We love community.
Exactly. It's great. Look it up. It's on YouTube. So, but they're on the Atlantis cruises. I'm still doing some of the piano bar stuff, but I'm also music directing for a bunch of their main stage performers, which is really fun and quick and, you know, suddenly I'm music directing for Andy Bell from Erasure.
Oh, wow.
Because he needs somebody to play for him.
Yeah.
So, the last cruise I did, I was suddenly playing for Deborah Cox and, you know, orchestrating her show. So it's so fun and really, like, you gotta be on it. I played, 14 shows on each of the last two cruises that I played for Atlantis.
That's a lot.
So, it's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot, but it's really fun, and they're amazing. They put on such incredibly huge, mammoth events, and this is like the best week ever. There's so much to do.
And there are perhaps one or two attractive people there on the cruise.
There are. It's hilarious because people actually write in, and they're like, do you have to be built to go on Atlantis cruise? Because everyone on their website is stunning and jacked to within an inch of their lives, just like built as all hell. And the answer is no. There's really like everybody you've ever met, every type of gay. And occasionally some bring their random female friends to just hang out and have that experience.
You would never know it.
Mom.
You would never know it, because I would have assumed that Atlantis in some language means body dysmorphia from looking at their brochures.
Exactly. It's, you don't have to be. It's really, and it's a really kind of a great community.
All right.
It becomes like a little kind of floating, basically like Provincetown on a boat.
I've never been there either.
Oh, field trips. Let's go.
I'm ready. Now, this is the second week in a row, and this was entirely unintentional. The second week in a row, we've had a musical connection to Danielle of The Real Housewives of New Jersey. Last week, we had lesbian superstar Lori Michaels on the show, and now it's you.
Oh, my God. Well, hi, Lori. I haven't seen her in an age.
Oh, she was wonderful. You're not only connected, but there's a dedication to you. You are in the acknowledgement section of Danielle's book.
I am?
Are you kidding? Breaking news. Yes, you are. I can read it to you.
I didn't know that. Well, that's lovely. Well, thank you. That's spectacular.
Do you want to explain at all how you're connected to her? I actually think it's kind of awesome to just let people imagine, but tell us a little bit how you somehow got that connection.
Well, I got a call from a friend and it was very secretive, that, you know, somebody was looking for a voice teacher for a youngish person. And do I do that? Yeah, I've, you know, taught Martin Johnson, who's the lead singer of this band, Boys Like Girls, that's, you know, huge and on Columbia and all the kids love them, was actually my first voice student when he was 12. So I'm like, yeah, I've done that. I've taught younger voices. So he's like, I can't tell you who it is yet until I connect you. And it was Danielle's youngest daughter, Jillian, who is lovely and just the sweetest little kid, and writes, like, actually writes pretty decent songs.
Nice.
And is fun and adorable. But I had actually never seen an episode of Real Housewives of New Jersey, so I had no idea who Danielle actually was. So they connected me, got on the phone with her. She seemed nice and lovely. And then I drove out to Jersey, you know, for every week for a year and some change, giving voice lessons to Jillian and helping her with her songwriting.
And the result is page 200 of the text, The Naked Truth, the real story behind the Real Housewife of New Jersey. She made it singular, which is hilarious. And I quote, Brian Nash, thank you for being an inspiration to my daughter Jillian and helping her to develop her art and voice in music into something more than fabulous.
Oh,
that's awesome. That's awesome. Well, we're going to let you go, but we got to make you very quickly play the game that we make so many of our musical artists play. This is the part of the show. It's a little bit of a game where you tell our listening audience what some song selections say about you. It's a little self-analysis of Brian Nash.
Ooh.
And what I did was I chose some songs that I know that you at least used to play regularly. Now I have no idea because apparently piano bars aren't so gay. My assumption is you're still gay, but I guess we should check.
Oh, they're pretty gay. I mean, I gay it up.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So a couple songs and what they say about you, okay? I'll only make you do two. And so we got to go back to Tori. We're going back to Tori, one of the songs that people can listen to you play online and sing. What does Tori's Caught a Light Sneeze say about Brian Nash?
Ooh. That song connects me really, really strongly to a very particular time. Like, that's 96, senior year of high school, and then freshman year of college when I would go and sneak up into the that was when Tori was living with a lot of harpsichord. So sneaking into the recital hall at Boston Conservatory and digging into a harpsichord for the first time and figuring out what that sound is and how that playing technique works.
Very cool.
The song is very, you know, it's about moving on, it's about freedom. But I think, you know, for me, it's me at 18 figuring out a harpsichord.
Nice. All right, one more. Now, I've seen you do this many a time. It is perhaps the most audacious way to start a set. I don't know if you still do it. I don't know because I haven't seen you play in quite some time. What does the song Anthem from the musical Chess say about Brian Nash?
Anthem says to me, my voice has changed. I'm 16 years old and I can't sing on my own anymore. So I need to find some baritonal goodness. And that recording, the American cast recording of Chess, not the British one, which is brilliant and I love it. But I grew up on the Judy Kuhn, David Carroll recording of Chess, the American cast, which is amazing. And I'm obsessed with Judy Kuhn and she's phenomenal. I would put her on mixtapes for both of my friends. She was great. But that is, I'd do it early on in the set just to kind of rip my throat open and see if I can get through the next 7 hours of singing.
Nice.
Singing that lets me know what my voice is going to do for another 7 hours.
Love it. Now, if folks wanted to, they could go to Christopher Street and 7th Avenue and catch you at the Duplex Sunday nights?
Indeed. Sunday nights and Friday nights as well.
Friday nights. Is Mostly Sondheim still going on?
That's Friday night.
Absolutely. Let me tell you listeners about Brian Nash. He is one of those guys who you can meet him on the street and you can talk to him at the bar and it will be a perfectly lovely conversation. He's a nice enough guy. It's fine. But then, how is that? You can take that and run with it. Then he sits down to the piano. You have to know this about you. My assumption is you know this about you. You become just a completely different person. The degree to which you light up when you sit down and start playing, and then everyone who is watching you lights up, is really one of the most incredible experiences. I have actually had the experience of seeing you there and thinking, I can't even believe that's the same guy. Because the degree to which, and I mean that in, I hope, what's coming across, the best possible way, it is, you are a performer. you really do light up an audience. And if folks have the opportunity, go to New York City, do an Atlantis cruise, whatever you need to do to go see Brian play, because it really is a thing to behold.
Oh, thank you. It's weird. I don't know what I would do if I had never sat down to play, if I was just kind of still rocking out the opera dream. It's where I feel kind of the most at home. So
there you go. There you go. Brian Nash, Gang It Up at the Duplex and on Atlantis Cruises. Please go check him out. Brian, what a treat having you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks. This has been hilarious.
Snow can wait. I forgot my mittens. Wipe my nose. Get my new boots on. I get a little warm in my heart when I think of winter. I put my hand in my father's glove. I run off where the drifts get deeper. Sleeping Beauty trips me with a frown. I hear a voice, you must learn to stand up for yourself, 'cause I can't always be around. When you gonna make up your mind? When you gonna love you as much as I do? When you gonna make up your mind? 'Cause things are gonna change so fast. All the white horses are still in bed. I tell you that
all right, folks, and we are back. Well, that brings us to our favorite and only recurring segment on this show, Is So Gay. We love to call it
Love Will Come to You.
Welcoming back to the show, Dr. Frankie. Dr. Frankie is the CEO and founder of Little Gay Book, a local personalized boutique matchmaking service. She holds a doctorate in the field of psychology and is an expert in the field of human behavior and matching with tons of years of experience. And now she's back with us to answer your amazing questions. Dr. Frankie, welcome back to this show, Is So Gay.
Thank you for having me back. I'm really excited to hear the questions.
Do you know it's already been 2 months since you've last been on the show? It always seems like
no.
A week. It was 2 months ago.
Oh, my gosh. Scary. Scary how time flies. Wow. Well, I always enjoy being on your show, and the questions are usually really interesting and sometimes have me baffled myself. So,
well, before we get to this month's questions, we need to clarify your position on last time you were on the show, a segment, because we did get some angry emails from some ASPCA folks who feel that you pretty much said that people should put their cats down.
Oh, no. That was not my intention. I like cats. They're just too aloof for me. That's my issue. I like cats. And, you know, I think, like, 99% of lesbians have, like, more than one cat.
There you go. All right, PETA, you know? PETA people, please direct your inquiries to the Little Gay Book Facebook page and not the This Show Is So Gay page. Thank you. Thank you.
Much appreciated.
All right. All right, you ready to go?
I'm ready.
Tons of questions. Oh, man, these are so good. All right, we'll start with fun. Well, maybe it's fun. We'll see. Dear Dr. Frankie, how do you introduce a fetish into a relationship where you've made no previous mention of said fetish? Signed, name withheld for obvious reasons.
Interesting. So, the first thought that came to mind is testing the waters.
Okay.
You want to just kind of explore how this person sort of feels about fetishism. You know, and by just asking them questions around it, like, and have they experienced any, you know, any, or do they have any interest in fetishes, or do they know people who have had fetishes? Are they curious? Like, I would just explore with them their experience of fetish. Yeah, I would be really careful, because I think it's the kind of thing where once you understand what a fetish is, and it's sort of it's not as unknown, you know what I mean? And it's easier to wrap our brains around it. But initially, if you don't have much exposure and you don't really understand what it is or what it means, I think it can be really scary and intimidating. And one could assume certain things or have sort of, you know, judgments about what it means to for somebody to be interested in a fetish.
So communication pretty big on this one.
Yes, and I would take it slow, and I would just kind of take the Columbo approach of, like, just being curious about what they think about it, if they've had any exposure to it, and what their thoughts are around it. I wouldn't just come out and say, hey, this is my fantasy, and I see you playing this role. You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
But not necessarily over Thanksgiving dinner either.
No.
Okay.
So just go light, you know, and it's like dip your toe in the pond and see.
All right.
Do a little litmus test and see. Get a gauge on how this person feels about it to begin with. And if they feel, you know, if you're getting the sense that they're curious and open, I would just start, you know, talking a little bit about your thoughts about it, maybe the more milder parts of it, and just slowly build up to your, like, ultimate fantasy, you know, or ultimate idea of how you would play out your fetish, that kind of thing.
All right.
We're going to take our time
with that one. Question number two. This is a big one. Dear Dr. Frankie, what are some of the red flags to look for when dating, signed Betty in California?
Wow. So that's a good question. This is a common question that I get.
I bet.
Yes. So I think one big red flag is, say you go on a date and you decide you're going to, you know, get drinks. And, you know, you have one drink and then you decide you're having a good time and you decide to have another drink and you realize, you know what, that's enough for me. Like, I'm still in control of my behavior and what I'm communicating, and I'm going to hold off on drinking another drink because I know it's going to start to distort my ability to accurately assess, you know, this person and control how much information I'm sharing, right?
Right.
And this individual keeps drinking and seems to be, you know, sort of spilling over. So the way I describe it, they spill. They start to overshare. They seem like they don't have that much self-control. So over-drinking, you know, that's a common one. Somebody who's overly disclosing on a first date, like if they have a trauma history or any kind of trauma, you know, or any big life events that have occurred in their life and they're sort of sharing more than you feel comfortable hearing,
right?
That's a red flag. What's another red flag? Somebody who, you know, is really nonchalant about running late, doesn't seem very, like, apologetic or isn't owning the fact that they're...
I can't stand that.
Yes, that happens, and it's insane how much it happens, right? It happens more often than we'd like to admit.
I have two celebrity references for that. One, I might have made this up and maybe it didn't really happen, but I remember being little and watching Oprah, as naturally I would as a little gay boy in New Jersey, and it was when she first had Dr. Phil on before he got his own show, and some woman in the audience raised her hand and said, because he was just taking random questions, she said, oh, I'm just always late and I just can't seem to be on time, to which Dr. Phil turned to this woman in his no-nonsense way and said, yeah, that's because you're incredibly egotistical. You pretty much expect that people are going to wait for you.
Yes. It just really is not taking other people's time. Like, it's just not – it's disrespectful.
Yeah.
You're not being respectful of one's time.
I can't
and I think
stand it.
Right, that will translate into so many other things. And I just, it's that early of, you know, the process, that stage of the game, if they're already being that disrespectful, that's a major red flag, you know. And then not owning it, like, things happen, right? We're all juggling a million different things at the same time. Just own it. Hey, I'm so sorry. Your time is important. I get it. And I just want you to know that, like, this is an anomaly, and I apologize.
Yeah.
Period. That's it.
Yeah, Ellen. Ellen also has a very funny line about that. And again, I don't do Ellen impressions or really any impressions. But Ellen has, you know, she gets annoyed when people are late, and the person always says, "Oh, there was just tons of traffic." And Ellen said, "Yeah, we account for those kinds of things. We take them into account when we're going someplace." I would be so excited for a first date. I mean, I have a date in a couple weeks, and I'm going to be there starting tomorrow.
So then, you know, nothing will interfere with you being there and being very present.
Just the hygiene aspect, just that. But I don't know.
Exactly.
I get so excited for something like that, or just going out with someone for whom I am excited to spend time with, and I freak out if I'm late, and at least say to them, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry.
Exactly.
Yeah. All
exactly.
Right.
So that's definitely another red flag. What's another red flag?
Yeah, give us one more.
Somebody who cancels less than 24 hours in advance. You know, it's like, yeah, I think that's really rude.
Yeah.
I think that's a red flag.
Without being mortified. You know, like you can cancel within 24 hours, but you got to really bend over backwards and be mortified and apologetic. Like, again, stuff happens, but...
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Say you wake up and you're feeling really sick. It's like, I feel terrible. I know that, you know, I want to bring my best self forward, right? And I look terrible. I feel terrible. So it'd be better, and I don't want to get you sick.
Right.
It'd be better that we just reschedule. Let's talk about, you know, a date now. You know what I mean? So the person doesn't feel like they're getting blown off.
Right. And with this...
Right away, what do we think? Right?
And like, with this extra time, please think about this fetish that I'm considering.
Exactly.
Just combine the questions.
Yeah.
All right. All right. All right. So this next question, I think something might have happened, but, you know, we won't make any assumptions about our listeners and what they submit. Ben in Denver wants to know, dear Dr. Frankie, why the hell do people run away from someone they have serious feelings for?
You know, we're all, I would say, actually most of us are afraid of rejection and abandonment at the core, right, at the deepest level. Even folks who have not had trauma in their lives, we are afraid of being abandoned, of being left. So when people start to feel intense feelings, sometimes they get overwhelmed and that fear starts to become way more obvious and evident and overwhelming, and they bolt. If they don't have the kind of internal voice or coping strategies to reassure themselves that it's okay, that this is a normal part of experiencing intense feelings, and that, you know, it's, yes, there's a risk involved. So we have the soothing side of ourselves that can remind us that it's okay. You know, we're taking the risk in dating, and now that we finally are excited and we're feeling really good feelings, that it's okay to feel these scary, anxious feelings at the same time.
Is that a red flag, though? I don't want to combine the questions, but so someone who bolts, how much of a red flag is that?
Yeah, so it can be, right? You hear of people that are like, quote-unquote, commitment phobes.
Right.
And it's just too hard for them to stay present for any length of time or any significant length of time. So, you know, it can be a red flag. I think that it's worth giving the person a chance to explain what's happening. I think it's important that, you know, that individual has the ability to articulate what it is they're feeling and be able to make sort of connect the dots and make sense of why they're acting the way that they're acting.
Right.
So that the other person that's starting to notice this person's withdrawing, right, they can say, I get it. Like, you had a bad breakup, right? Like, your most recent relationship went sideways, the person completely up and left. Like, you came home to an empty house. I get it. So, you know what I mean? Some people are willing to work with that and support their potential partner, you know what I mean, in that if there's enough positive that outweighs that one sort of red flag. But if they have no insight and they have no ability to kind of make sense of it and verbalize it to you, run.
Not good.
Run the other way.
Not good. All right. So noted. All right. Well, this next question, dear Dr. Frankie, I love this question. I actually really do love this question for personal reasons as well. Do I have to maintain a relationship with my ex? I don't want to, but my friends say that will change. Why? Why does this have to change? Signed, needs new friends in Boca Raton.
Oh, gosh. Well, maybe, I mean, this person's in Boca, so maybe there are very few gay people in Boca, and if you have an ex that is, like, potentially friendship quality, they don't want you to be left with no friends. Because in Boca, what is the, like, queer population? I can't even imagine.
I love that you made this question geographically based.
I know I've lived in Boca. I know. It's just limited, right? So anyway, back to the question. I feel like if you don't want to be friends with your ex, you don't need to be friends with your ex. You know, there. I'm sure that you may have to drive a little further to Fort Lauderdale or to, you know, to South Beach to meet other gay folks if that's part of it, you know. But I don't feel like you need to be friends with an ex if you don't want to be friends with an ex. And in time, you know, if you decide you want to be friends, you can always try to, you know, nurture a relationship, a friendship with that person. You don't have to do that now. So I think maybe asserting herself with her friends would be a good idea and just setting a boundary, like, this is okay. This is my decision. This is my ex-girlfriend. I don't want to be friends with her right now, but I appreciate your input.
Do you think I have to tell my friend? So my friend is getting married next summer, and I know that my ex-husband will be at the wedding. Do I actually have to specifically tell my friend not to put us at the same table, or can I just assume that she knows that?
I would tell your friend.
Okay.
I would tell, yes.
I almost want to cut this interview short because I have a phone call to make, but we have a couple more questions for you.
All right.
It's good to cover this. Another kind of X question. By the way, this next question has the best signature that we will ever have in both the past, your past appearances, and any future appearances you have on the show. So I'm just putting that out there. Dear Dr. Frankie, my girlfriend habitually refers to her ex-wife as her wife. They've been broken up for years and have no relationship, and it just really seems to be a slip of the tongue. Or is it? Signed. I'm just cracking up. Signed. Love her boobage, hate her verbiage.
Nice. I love that. So, we all know what Freud would have said, right? That...
It's her mother?
On some unconscious level, some unconscious level, she, you know, in her mind may, you know, still consider this person, you know, her ex-girlfriend, her wife or her ex-wife, her wife in some way, but it might be unconscious. So, you know, I don't know. I think that we get so used to calling our partners certain names and labeling, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, I think it's also almost like muscle memory. It's automatic. So if it's recent, I don't know how long. We don't have a timeline, right?
We don't.
How recent. So I feel like if it's recent, I think there's in some ways you've got to be forgiving when people accidentally say wife, if you know, if it's more recent. If it's a long time ago, that's concerning,
right?
That she keeps doing that. That would offend me over time. That would really bother me. So I think that for obvious reasons it's bothering, you know, this person that wrote in, and
right.
I think it's something definitely to address and to emphasize that it makes you feel uncomfortable, and that maybe for her it's not something she's really given much thought to, but maybe it'd be a good time to, like, open it up for a discussion about it, because it's hard for me based on that question to really have an opinion about what it means, but I know that it's bothering her because she wrote it in.
Right.
And it's something that I think should be discussed because it would bother me too, for sure.
Well, maybe something that you could answer on the scales of a relationship, if we have a scales of a relationship in front of us, how do you weigh out, compare and contrast boobage versus verbiage?
I don't know. That's a big one. I don't know. I'm almost thinking that the boobage is going to outweigh the verbiage.
Now, is that geographically based, or does that apply everywhere, or just in Boca? Is that a Boca thing? I love it.
Is this a Boca question again?
Not that I know of. This one did not come from Boca. I think this was a Chicago listener. So there you go.
Then there's more options.
Okay. I love this. I love it. I love it. All right. This question. I have to say that I've never encountered this, I won't say issue because I don't want to problematize it, but I've not encountered this phenomena, or maybe I just wasn't aware of it in Vermont as now that I've moved to Cleveland. Doubtful in Jersey writes, Dr. Frankie, open relationships, can they really and seriously work?
So that's a good question, because I think in my experience, for a very small number of folks, it can work, but with a lot of work and an effort and trust. So there's got to be a lot of communication. Open communication, trust, and understanding and sensitivity to boundaries. So yes, it can work, but I think it takes a lot of effort. And I think a lot of us it's just hard to be that vulnerable all the time and talk about your fears and talk about your fantasies regularly with your partner and your boundaries and all of these things that sometimes you just want to keep things to yourself, right? Sometimes
right.
But I think when you open the relationship up, it's almost like you need to agree to lay it all out on the line, because there's so much room for misunderstanding, misinterpretation, and just being triggered, right?
Yeah.
Our past experience is coming up currently because we're, again, afraid of abandonment. We are uncomfortable when we experience feelings of being threatened or feelings of jealousy, right?
Right.
So it's just complicated, but I'm not totally opposed, or I don't feel like it's impossible. I think it's just really, really challenging for most people.
Do people ever come to you? Do any clients ever come to you and say, you know, I'm looking for someone else, but I am currently in an open relationship?
Yes. So I work with polyamorous couples. I mean, people will come to me because I do a lot of coaching.
Right.
As well. So, but with matchmaking, I don't do matchmaking for folks that, you know, are looking for a third or a fourth, that kind of thing.
Okay.
No. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be complicated. You know, one of the interesting things about the open relationship is the friends piece, you know, because we do represent our relationships in certain ways to the people around us. And I feel like I'm so Little House on the Prairie, although maybe they had open relationships too. I don't know. But I sometimes get a little bit uncomfortable. Like if I'm on, and you know, you've been on the show a ton, so I can overshare with you and all of our listeners. If I'm on some online app, you know, and I'm like meeting people and I see friends of mine who I now am learning are in an open relationship because they're on the online app, I am extraordinarily uncomfortable. And I like don't even want to be around them because I'm uncomfortable. I feel like I know too much.
Interesting. And do you feel like their interest in you is anything other than platonic?
No, I think it's completely platonic. I just didn't know that it was an open relationship and it's something that they've never shared and kind of, I would say, patently and blatantly not shared. So I'm just uncomfortable with the knowledge, but I like hearing from you that it doesn't have to be this kind of seedy thing. Oh, maybe these are my issues.
I mean, that you bring up, I haven't even thought about that. That's a really interesting idea. And I think that if, of course, it's something that they've never brought up, so you would be naturally so. You'd be uncomfortable with it. But I feel like more and more people are becoming more comfortable sharing
right.
And just because, you know, it's less stigmatized.
Right.
And people are really trying to make their long-term relationships work, and they're seeing that monogamy doesn't always work for everybody.
Right.
So they're trying alternatives, and it's becoming more acceptable. So that would be hard. If I noticed my friends were on this app and they had an open relationship, it would be hard, and they were good friends, it would be hard for me not to say something.
Yeah, I'm not saying a damn word. Let's be clear on this one. And maybe that's one of my things is that I shouldn't – I guess I assume that the default of a relationship is a monogamous one, and I guess that's my bad.
Oh, that could be it too.
Yeah.
Just that assumption. Yeah.
Challenge our assumptions, yep. Challenge our assumptions. Mm-hmm. And then this last question comes from Ken in Cleveland, and he's also the host of this radio show. And he came up with this question after doing some research on the current guest on this radio show. So I would like to ask Dr. Frankie, are people who do CrossFit not to be trusted?
Oh!
Let me describe to people the picture that is currently on Facebook for all to see. For all to see, there's a G.I. Jane thing happening on your Facebook right now.
So I'm a little obsessed with CrossFit. It's been 2 years, and I can't get enough. And finally, after all of my hard work, I am seeing some really awesome changes and progress. And I just had to share it with my friends. And I'm not somebody that really posts a lot of, especially that kind of stuff. Like, hey, look at me do this really cool toes to bar move, you know?
Yeah.
But you just work so hard that you feel proud, you know, when you make some real progress that you see and you yourself can admit, which is huge, right? We're our biggest critics. So I can admit, wow, all my hard work is paying off. So yes, that's the photo that you saw.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And yes, we can be trusted. We're very committed, very just we like to get beat up on a daily basis.
Nice.
Physically.
Yeah, because right? Freud wouldn't have a field day with that.
Exactly. But yeah, we value health and
okay.
Exercise and friendship. Because it's an environment where you can meet people.
Love
so
it.
I love my gym also because I have made some really cool friends from the gym. So
I will now explain to you how I felt triggered by that picture. I was instantly cast back, and you'll recall this quite well because we are the same age from the same place. I will instantly, my mind went to the presidential fitness challenge that we used to do in New Jersey when you had to do the flexed arm hang, and I had some difficulties with that, and they comped me the time because I was really good at the clarinet and tennis. So there you go. That's really what I wanted to think about when I go to your Facebook page. Thank you.
Oh, no, Ken. Should I take it down?
You should
I'll
not.
I'll do that for you. I love you that much. I'll take it down.
Well, let me tell you how much I love you, because only a handful of folks have been allowed to do the parting line of the show. I'm letting you close the show this week. So when we get to it, and you will know exactly when it is, your key phrase is going to be "so gay," okay?
Yes.
You're going to know. You're going to know. All right, folks.
I hope so. My gosh. This is like an IQ test. I'm scared.
I'm feeling confident. We're both these New Jersey accomplished, one of us does CrossFit people. So here we go.
Okay.
Folks, thank you so much for listening. Our thanks, of course, to Dr. Frankie. Thank you, Dr. Frankie.
Thank you.
And, of course, to Brian Nash, who was on earlier. Loved having him on. You should go check him out in New York City. Get out there, folks. Go do some incredible things. Use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBT brothers and sisters. And, of course, while you're out there in the world making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be
so gay?
Right on time, you get closer and closer.